This is The Reason Interview, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. At the 2000 Republican National Convention, the country got one of its first glimpses of a new type of public charter school. The claim was that with enough rigor, devotion, and no excuses discipline, such schools could close the achievement gap between poor minorities and their wealthy white counterparts. The shining example was the Knowledge is Power program, or KIPP. Skeptics pointed out that the families showing up at KIPP and other no-excuses charters were self-selected. In 2006, a combative former New York City Council member named Eva Moskowitz co-founded a new charter school network with the same approach. Success Academy was KIPP on steroids, trouncing many public schools in wealthy neighborhoods on the annual state exams. Enter the education writer and former public school teacher Robert Pondicio, who spent a year embedded at a Success Academy school in an effort to figure out just how they did what they did. In his widely praised new book, How the Other Half Learns, Pondicio reports that the critics were right. Not only is the very act of applying to the lottery self-selecting, but Success Academy makes such rigorous demands on parents that it disproportionately retains only the most highly motivated families. The result is that an applicant's chances of winning a seat at a success school in its annual high-stakes lottery aren't as competitive as many had claimed. Pondicio found that there's about 6 applicants for every spot, but because so many families drop out along the way, the chances of actually getting offered a spot are pretty close to 50%. But for those who do make the commitment, the impact is absolutely transformative. And he argues that these kids deserve the same access to excellent public schools that upper-middle-class parents finagle for their children, even if it means leaving the rest of their communities behind. I sat down with Pondicio to discuss why he believes motivated families deserve the opportunity to exit their traditional public schools, which the New York Times reviewer called a morally disturbing conclusion to his unsparingly honest book, and his challenge to both supporters and detractors of the school reform movement. Robert Pondicio, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thanks for having me.
Let me start with the question, who is Tiffany and why does she matter?
Oh, you're going to try to make me emotional. First question, huh? Mm-hmm. Tiffany was a student in my second year of teaching at PS 277 in the South Bronx. And this was a little girl who I like to just, you know, tell this story. She would come to school every day in her uniform. The building could fall down and Tiffany would be behind her desk scribbling away. And when I pointed out to my special ed supervisor at the time that, look, I've got this kid, I'm not doing anything for her, I'm basically ignoring her. And she said, verbatim quote, she's not your problem. Mm-hmm. Meaning, you know, why are you focusing your attention? Why are you concerned at all about Tiffany? She's delivering the results we need. But by the same token, this was a kid who was deeply bought into what we were doing. So she ended up moving to Pennsylvania, graduating from a, you know, perfectly fine state university. But I've been troubled for the last 15 years. Like, what could this kid have been if she were in one of these so-called no excuses charter schools where, mm-hmm. you know, she was pushed to go not just to college, but to a terrific college. You know, the ultimate achievement gap in American life is in test scores. It's the leadership gap. You know, we'd all be working for this kid with her incredible work habits.
So, you know, the thesis of your book is that Success Academy is the type of school for the Tiffanys of the world.
Yeah, I think that's right.
So are the success schools actually a random lottery? Are they random? How does success?
Yeah, this is complicated, but it's worth unpacking. The moment a parent raises his or her hand and says, I want a charter school instead of the neighborhood default mm-hmm. public school, I would argue that parent is almost instantly setting himself or herself apart from the parent who exercises no choice whatsoever. You're at least curious about what else is out there.
So describe the average success parent then.
Yeah, and again, I'm going to keep saying this, but this is also anecdote, not data, because the data is just not available to my knowledge. So I spent a year embedded in a school in the South Bronx, literally across the street mm-hmm. from where I was a student teacher and in the same neighborhood where I taught Tiffany and others. I went on a fifth or a second grade field trip at one point, and I promise you I'm not making this up. There were more dads chaperoning that field trip than I saw in 5 years of parent-teacher mm-hmm. conferences in my old school. Observably, every morning you see fathers, you see couples, married couples, or at least cohabitating couples yeah. dropping their kids off. So a pattern emerges, and I got to know quite a few parents, and the way I describe it, they are overrepresented, married, employed, almost invariably religious and or spiritual, ambitious mm-hmm. for their children.
What's the level of minority?
100%.
Yeah. Okay, so this isn't, you're not describing people who are, you know, a kind of double income, highly professional, white, middle-class, yuppie, Asian.
I'm not saying it's not going to happen. Yeah. And in some other neighborhoods with Success Academy, it certainly is.
Right.
But the school that I was teaching or embedding in the South Bronx is not really gentrifying at this point the way other neighborhoods in New York City are.
And Success will say, what is it? It's something like, or it seems that for every slot at Success, there's what, something like 40 students or
6 to 1. There are 6 more applicants for every seat than entering the lottery than ultimately end up getting placed.
Why is that a misleading statistic?
And this is take some unpacking too. The enrollment lottery is the first step in the process. Mm-hmm. Once you so let's say, and this is from memory, I think there were something like 17,000 applicants for 3,000 seats the year that I was at Success. 3,000 are immediately seated and are told, congratulations, you're in. Mm-hmm. 7,000 are told, sorry, no room at the inn, as it were. The rest, which is another 6,000 or 7,000, are placed on a so-called likely list. Mm-hmm. Remember that term, likely.
And this is all random assignment.
Absolutely, yeah. 100% random. So then the next step is you're invited to a welcome meeting, which is kind of a little bit scared straight. I mean, to Success Academy's mm-hmm. credit, they could not be more clear about what they stand for and what they will not stand for. Like they will say, the one person who I quote in the book said, this is not Burger King. You don't get to have it your way. Mm-hmm. There are uniforms. These are the hours. We will suspend your kid as early as kindergarten if they break our rules, etc. So they could not be more clear or emphatic about their school culture. That scares some folks away. Mm-hmm. Or if you don't show up to the welcome meeting and you don't reschedule, then you were dropped. Then comes a confirm your interest email. Then comes a uniform fitting day. Then comes a dress rehearsal for kindergarten. At every step along the way, some number fall away. And we don't know why. Perhaps there mm-hmm. are a lot of other charter schools. They decide, no, I'd rather go to that one than this one. But at the end of the day, what's undeniable is your chances of getting in are closer to 1 in 2. And because of this kind of aggressive acculturation that goes on during this process, my thesis on this, and I think Success somewhat disagrees with this, is you end up with a parent body of either true believers or those who are willing to have their parenting kind of molded a little bit. Because Success makes prodigious demands on parents. You're going to read to your kids 6 books a week. You're going to check the homework. You're going to fill out the reading logs. You got to drop your kid off every morning by 7:30. You got to pick your kid up every day at, I think, 3:45. Wednesday's a half day, 12:30. There's no after school. There's no transportation. And again, I don't want to paint the picture that this is being done deliberately to cull the herd, right, so to speak. But as a practical matter, it's just easier to comply with these school culture demands if you've got the bandwidth of 2 parents, or at least a support network, right, where you've got somebody. So if you're living a kind of chaotic, disorganized life, it's just kind of hard to do that.
Yeah. So this all goes towards your thesis, really, that they're not creaming students.
Yeah.
To get, and we'll talk about the results and how good the people who go through the Success Academy seem to be doing, but that they're creaming the parents.
Yeah, and you know, I'll be honest, Nick, I wish I hadn't framed it that way, that they are creaming or cherry-picking parents, because at the end of the day, those parents are creaming or cherry-picking themselves,
right?
My more nuanced point, I hope, is that it's not, oh, it's the parents, stupid. It's the conditions, the cultural conditions, the school culture conditions that self-selection sets in motion. Mm-hmm. Look, you know, if you have a just-so school culture with that is high expectations, very demanding, etc., you can't impose that on people. You know, you have to at least start with those who want it or those who are willing to have their efforts directed. In other words, this simply would not work to impose this on my old school or almost any other school. So it's a more complicated thing than it's the parents. It's the starting line. It creates the buy-in, and that's the key idea, that makes this level of rigor and high expectation doable.
Is Success Academy representative of the charter movement as a whole or successful schools as a whole?
That's a really great question. I mean, and I don't think I have a firm conclusion about this. I think I asked the question in the book, because the entire idea of ed reform for the last 20-odd years has been, you know, if you have the right conditions, every child can learn at a high level. Success Academy's results are so unusually good that it raises the question, is this a proof point or is this kind of the reverse perfect storm that in its relative rarity proves that this really is not, you know, widely doable?
Well, now what you're talking about is different than the way that Eva Moskowitz talks about what Success does. And she says look, our model will work for 99.9% of kids, that it is the school that's transformational, not things that are happening before and after and things like that, you know, other than that they do their homework. Is that just wrong?
Wow. I mean, who am I to disagree with Eva Moskowitz? I mean, she's created this fantastic network of schools, and I'm just, you know, some guy who sat in them. But yeah, I kind of disagree with that. Or in other words, the proof point there would be, well, then take 99.9% of students, and they don't do that. Mm-hmm. And, I, you know, this puts me in an awkward position because at the end of the day, I'm strongly supportive of what they do, but I just don't think that that's what they're doing. Because if that is what you were doing, then you wouldn't put those hurdles in front of kids. You would just, you do the opposite. You take the first 100 kids in the door and you'd fight like hell to keep those 100 kids in the door. So it's weird to me to think that, you know, on the one hand, you say that you can do this with 99.9% of kids, but you have these structures in place that, and again, I'm mm-hmm. defending this, that allow parents to self-sort. If that's your theory, then wouldn't you want to prove that you can do this with every child?
So, I mean, that's an argument that Success Academy is really not representative of the charter of the schools that are in the charter movement, because
I think that's right.
Okay, and could you,
there's a range.
Could you contrast, maybe briefly? You teach at a school called Democracy Prep. What is its guiding ethos, and is it as successful as Success Academy?
What do you mean by successfulness?
I don't. Well, you pick it. I'm giving you the option to define success downward.
Sure. This is why we could talk about this till the cows come home. The way we keep score, and I'm using that phrase, not success. The standard measure of performance is test scores. I have a complicated relationship with test scores. I don't mm-hmm. think that they are necessarily the alpha, and they are certainly not the alpha and omega, and there's other things that I'd like to look at as well. So mm-hmm. by rights, I should probably intensely dislike what I saw at Success, because to be brutally blunt, they put test prep on steroids. Mm-hmm. Even the curriculum is arguably even a bit test preppy when it's not test prep season. Yet I got to the end of this experience and I found myself saying, but you know, I kind of like what I'm seeing here. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, I think it had more to do with what my bet would be their long-term outcomes. And I describe this at some length in the book. There is simply nothing in the experience or history for a low-income family of color in this country to expect a good relationship with a place called a school. I mean, it's like the school where I taught. I mean, it's where you go to see how little is expected of you, how narrow your horizons are. So even though I don't like necessarily that they are test prepping kids out the wazoo, it adds up to something powerful. So think of this, you know, you're in a school and you're a 10-year-old kid, and the test that you're being prepared for, nobody's telling you it's easy, quite the mm-hmm. opposite, they're telling you it's hard. You are surrounded by adults who are pushing you. You know, it's a tough love culture. They're calling your parents every night to say how you're doing on the most mm-hmm. recent test, the practice test. And then lo and behold, the testing day comes along, and not only do you do well, you do really well. You do better than kids in Scarsdale and Jericho mm-hmm. on Long Island. So think what that means. You're now growing up in an environment where I'm good at school, everybody I know is good at school, my parents are in on it, their parents are in on it. I think it just changes the temperature. So in a way, I'm not even sure Moskowitz thinks about it this way, but while I don't necessarily like the testing culture, I think it's a bit of a game changer, if I can use that cliche, in terms of the relationship that a kid feels like they're having with their school. Like, oh, I'm good at this. Right. This is going to take me someplace.
And one would assume that generalizes, or one would hope that generalizes beyond school.
Well, I think that's like, right.
Well, yeah, I, if I can accomplish this, I can do other things.
Well, not only that, I mean, the way I like to say this is the first and most impactful, or first and most important relationship a child has with a civic institution in this mm-hmm. country is almost invariably with the school. As that one goes, so goes the other. Mm-hmm. All the others. You know.
There's a review of your book in the New York Times ultimately said that you produced a morally disturbing conclusion to an unsparingly honest book. Part of the morally disturbing conclusion is that this is not for all people. Is that morally disturbing to you?
You could look at a kid like Tiffany and say, well, you know, we need her in this failing school because she's a good role model to the other kids, et cetera. And when you take that child away and send her to a charter school, mm-hmm. You're damaging the public school system. Well, you are. Let's be brutally honest. I mean, this is something we're not supposed to say in ed reform, but and there's data that suggests it's not true. But as a teacher, I know if you take Tiffany and three or four other kids like that out of my South Bronx classroom, My job is harder, not easier. Mm-hmm. Don't tell me that this is somehow going to benefit me. I would argue it is equally morally disturbing to not allow those who are ready, you know, to be upwardly mobile, to be fully and well educated. It's morally troubling that we deny that. Mm-hmm. I mean, my frame for this is, where do we get the right to treat anybody's child as a public resource, in a sense?
What about those other kids, yeah. though? I mean, are they, you know, do we just kind of write them off?
No.
And also related to this is the question of, like, is school actually that transformational? Because part of the presumption of all of these debates is yeah. that, you know, school is what matters, not all of these other things.
It can be more transformational than it is for more students, certainly. And again, I come back to the Tiffany example. School was insufficiently transformational. Perhaps. In 20 years, we might have yeah. a different conversation. The part of this book that, frankly, my ed reform colleagues should not like is where I take that idea. So, you know, there's been a strong strain of thought for years among defenders of traditional public schools. You can't compare these two things. You can't mm-hmm. compare the results of a traditional public school and a charter school, and it's unfair. And my answer is, well, that's right. It is unfair. But in the same way that it does not follow from that, therefore we should not allow choice, it does not follow from that we should tell the traditional public schools you should get as good a results as these schools with self-selected mm-hmm. parents. So if anything, that's an argument for perhaps more resources, better training, et cetera, for some folks in those schools. But we have to acknowledge that they have, when they say our job is harder, they're not lying. Their job is harder.
Let's, you know, focus a bit on the idea that it's morally troubling to allow certain people to escape a sinking boat or a yeah. listing ship, you know, that is just not going anywhere. People who make that argument, is it equally morally troubling to say, no, you know what, the morally good solution is to, you know, keep everybody in a boat that's not going anywhere yeah, but, or sinking.
Right, but Nick, nobody says that to me. Nobody says that to you. I mean, this is.
Isn't that the argument when people say, you know, we got to reduce school choice because it lets people who are motivated to take advantage of those choices get better outcomes?
Look, there's a big irony lurking in the room here, which is if you are affluent, white, whatever, you have de facto school choice right now. If you have the means to pay private school tuition or Catholic school tuition, you can do that. If you don't, you can at least pick up and move to, you know, Scarsdale or Greenwich right. or some such, where your property taxes are functionally your private school tuition. Right. Let's be really candid about that. So if this is your theory of change, then you need to explain why this is a problem for black and brown people only. In other words, when Eva Moskowitz mm-hmm. comes up with a way to give low-income black and brown families the functional level of choice that I have, that you have, mm-hmm. well, then why is that a problem? Why is it only a problem when somebody does it for them? It hasn't been a problem for decades for the rest of us. So somebody smarter than me needs to explain how you can live with those two opposing ideas in your head.
In the Wall Street Journal, you wrote that both sides are of the school choice debate are forced to be dishonest
yeah.
in arguments both for and against charter schools, resorting to aspirational, politically pleasing narratives about what it takes to improve outcomes for disadvantaged children.
Mm-hmm.
If charter school or school choice proponents are basically lying about the role that schools play in most people's lives, that's a problem.
I don't think it's dishonest.
And traditional public school supporters and teachers unions are saying, like, we can do this, we just need more and more resources. Well, that seems to be a lie, too, or misleading.
I think it's a politically necessary lie. I mean, I don't like accusing people of lying, but I think mm-hmm. it's the practical politics here demand that we be dishonest about that. In other words, support for charter schools would probably suffer if they were perceived as a sorting mechanism, as, you know, the so-called poor man's private school. Support for public schools, traditional public schools, would probably suffer if we were honest and say, look, we really can't do this for every mm-hmm. child right now. I don't have a good answer for this, to be blunt. The only thing I can offer is we talk all the time as teachers about meeting the children where they are. It might be helpful to start talking about meeting families where they are. You know, the family that is drawn to a Success Academy or another high-performing charter school that does their due diligence, that has that level of investment and buy-in, they're in a different place in their American trajectory, as it were, than a family that is suffering from any number of a parent in jail, unemployment, drug addiction, etc. One of the things I think we do incorrectly in this work is we tend to view urban communities through, you know, what I would call twin lenses of dysfunction. We either assume that everybody's broken and there are no families like the ones that are drawn to a Success Academy, or we assume that those who are married, employed, religious, ambitious for their children, we assume, like I was told with Tiffany, they're not your problem, which is horribly condescending. I mean, either one of those is terribly condescending, but we don't really differentiate enough.
Can we talk also briefly, you know, one of the knocks on Success mm-hmm. Academy in particular is that it's brutal, you know, not just to parents yeah. to say like, okay, you got to be doing your kids' homework every night. You got to make sure they're reading all these books. You got to show up when pick them up, drop them off, yeah. all of this type of stuff. But that they were literally brutal to the kids.
Yeah, I don't see that at all.
And, you know, there's a kind of viral footage of a teacher berating a little kid.
Yeah.
Did you see any evidence of that sort of stuff?
And this is where I think we have really done dirt to Moskowitz and Success Academy. Mm-hmm. Now, look, I'm not offended by the sight of kids marching in two lines in an elementary school. I'm not offended by the idea that kids should, you know, sit up, pay attention, make eye contact. And look, if you take nothing else away from this book and spending time at Success Academy, you cannot mistake the deep, authentic investment that teachers have in kids.
So very quickly, say, what is the thing that ed reformers who are kind of pro, you know, uncritically or maybe not so critically in favor of charter schools and in favor of Success Academy, what did they have to take away from this? And for traditional defenders of traditional public yeah. schools, what's the main point that they really need to grasp?
That's a great question. And at the risk of oversimplifying, I think we really have to focus on school culture. In other words, it's not enough. Testing isn't enough. Even the sorting, if mm-hmm. you want to call it that, isn't enough. Kids learn better when they are in an environment that valorizes achievement, if that's what you're trying to get, high achievement. And that's really, it's almost impossible for public policy to account for, because we don't allow parents, as a general rule, to self-sort. We don't allow, absent a voucher system, parents to pick a school culture that works for them. So if school culture really is the thing that drives achievement, that's a prodigious challenge for the ed policy world. How do we make that possible?
Would you agree that there's a large concerted pushback against charter schools?
Oh, unmistakable.
And is part of that related to them overselling their impact?
No, I think it's pure political expedience, honestly.
So what are the forces there?
Well,
that
I think
are most,
you know,
important?
If you look at, and I work for a policy shop, but I'm not really the best policy guy. I'm more of an instructional guy. But it's unmistakable that if you look at the run-up to the 2020 election, the Democrats who are, you know, want the White House seem to fall into two camps, those who are opposed to charter schools and those who are really opposed to charter schools. So, you know, the bipartisan...
And they mask that by talking, some of them talk about, I'm against for-profit charter schools, which are a negligible amount of charter schools.
I'm not invested enough, yeah. frankly, to even parse the differences. Mm-hmm. What I know is that it's disadvantageous to low income kids of color who have the ability right now to take advantage of these environments. And it's just, frankly, just weird to me that we have this category of school that has been making a difference for some number mm-hmm. of them, and that at least one party seems eager to throw them under the bus.
How do you evaluate whether or not, you know, this particular choice model or this particular choice is worth kind of pursuing?
I will admit that I have a fairly unsophisticated view of whether or not choice works. Here's how I view it. Did you get to choose? Do you like your choice?
This has been The Reason Interview. I've been your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at Spotify, at SoundCloud, at Reason.com, at Google, at Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.